He was born a slave, and he lived to know no master but God. He had a way with growing things, and a curiosity about them that was never satisfied. And in the end, he did more to free the South from a new kind of slavery than any other man, black or white, before or since. His name was George Washington Carver.
This is Inheritance, presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with the American Legion. Stories out of the great fabric of visions, struggles, and accomplishments of the American past. Stories of our inheritance.
The War of the States was nearly over, but in the levee country of southern Missouri, a strange and savage jungle warfare still went on. No armies fought here, only bands of guerrillas, bushwhackers, and bandits. Men no longer interested in any cause, but only in burning, plundering, kidnapping for ransom. Every night the raiders rode, and no honest farmer could sleep safe from fear that tonight they might strike at him.
Da 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 da. Oh, hush now, baby, don't you cry. Oh, Mr. Carver.
Run, the bushwhackers, they're coming again. Run and hide.
Yeah, but Mr. Carver, the baby's...
I'll carry the big one, you take the little one. Hurry!
Yeah, but the baby's sick. I... Oh, Lord, where's that medicine now? Oh, Lord! Lord, it's too late!
They were looking for money, but they found none. Instead, they took the woman Mary with them, the woman and her ailing baby. The man who had been their master, a bearded patriarchal German named Moses Carver, escaped. But Carver was too good a target, too prosperous a farmer to be let alone. The next night, another band of raiders swept down and caught him, tortured him in an effort to learn where he had hid his money. They failed, but they left him crippled. And for a few days he lay in his bed and brooded. Finally, he sent for a man he knew, a bushwhacker by the name of Bentley, and offered him a horse and 40 acres of timberland if he could find Mary and bring her back. A week passed, and then they returned, the weary horse and the weary rider, with a small bundle tied to the back of the saddle.
Here you are, Moses. That's all I could find. It's Mary's baby.
No, Mary.
No, oh. I got there too late. Baby was sick, so they give it away to a woman. But your Mary's gone. Nobody knows where. I was afraid the baby was going to die before I could get him back. Reckon he ain't apt to live long enough for it to make much difference to anybody.
The child was nearly dead from whooping cough and exposure, but still he did not die. Moses Carver's wife soon nursed him back to health, and he began to grow up, a thin, scrawny boy, too sickly and delicate for heavy work in the fields. They trained him in the lighter household tasks, and they taught him, too, to work in the garden. He had a way with growing things. Under his green thumb, plants and flowers would bloom miraculously where they withered and died for others. He had an inquiring mind, and as he worked, he wondered, why? What causes a flower or even a weed to grow? And there was no one to give him the answer. No place for him to find out. No school in Diamond Grove except for white children. Nothing at home to learn from but a Bible with a blue back speller. But at 10, he felt an overwhelming need.
So, George, you want to go to school. Well, the Freedmen's Bureau is opening a colored school in Neosho. I think myself you are still yet too young to get along on your own. But if you want to go there, I cannot stop you. You are a smart boy, George. So, go with God.
And down the road the 10-year-old went, to find himself a new home and an education, if possible, in Neosho, 8 miles away. A kind woman named Mariah Watkins took him in, cared for him, sent him to school. He was no longer known simply as Carver's boy, George. For school, he needed a name of his own. And the name was George Washington Carver. In 2 years, George had learned all that the school could teach him. He said goodbye to Mariah Watkins and became a wanderer, roaming wherever he could find more education and paying his way by doing odd jobs. He completed high school, then was turned down by the first college he tried to enter. No Negroes need apply. But a second one, Simpson College in Iowa, not only accepted him but gave him a scholarship, and he became the first member of his race to enroll there. He ran a student laundry to pay his way, sang in the glee club, played on the baseball team, learned to paint, and showed such talent at it that he thought of making it his career. But still, his main interest lay in the plant collection he'd gathered and kept all along the way. He transferred to Iowa State College at Ames, the finest school of agricultural science in the country.
George W. Carver, eh?
Yes, sir.
Transfer from Simpson College. I have a friend there, Miss Etta Budd. Her father's our professor of horticulture here.
Yes, sir, I know. I studied art under Miss Budd. She was very kind to me.
She wrote me a letter about you, Carver. Said you might have quite a future as a painter if you followed it up. So, why change to agriculture?
Because I'm a Negro, Mr. Wilson. Because I can be of more service to my race in agriculture.
Well, that's an honest statement. I suppose you can. All right. Let's see how much you can learn.
Within 5 years, he had become the best-trained Negro agriculturist in the United States. And while he was happy at Iowa State, he was not destined to stay. For something was shaping in the South. Down in Alabama, near the little town of Tuskegee, another great man, Booker T. Washington, had founded a school, Tuskegee Institute. Out of nothing but the burning needs of his people, out of nothing but hope and sweat and a dream, he was building the first college where Negroes would be taught by Negroes. And he needed a man like Carver to take charge of Tuskegee's agricultural department at $1,500 a year. Carver promptly accepted. The train had come and gone, leaving its passenger behind in the little way station of Cheehaw, Alabama, when the carriage from the Institute dashed up late. The student driver looked around for the man he'd been sent to meet, but the platform was bare. There was no one in sight but a lean, tall, stoop-shouldered young man down on his knees in a weed patch nearby.
You? Professor Carver? Well, I thought... Well,
I'm sorry if I kept you waiting.
Oh, that's all right. I found something to do. By the way, can you tell me what these plants are?
Oh, I don't know. Just look like old weeds to me.
I know, but what kind of weeds? I've never seen any like these up north. Don't they teach you to identify them in your plant biology class?
Oh, no, sir. We just learned about farming. Ain't no use in studying about weeds.
Well, you never know. Take the cocklebur. That's a weed. But you can turn it into medicine if you know how. Never can tell what'll turn out to be useful.
They rode through the raw red hills of Alabama, the bare eroded clayland where 4 acres out of every 5 had been ruined forever by the overplanting of the South's one crop, the soil-destroying king cotton. They passed the tumble-down sharecropper's cabins where families lived their lives away in ugliness and disease and utter poverty. They came to the campus of Tuskegee, still grim and bare and less than half finished. for there was so little money that the students must build all the buildings themselves. They showed the new professor his laboratory, or at least what passed for a laboratory.
Is this all the equipment? What do you use for a Bunsen burner?
Don't know. Don't think we ever had one.
What about retorts, freighters, pipettes?
What are those?
Pipettes. Glass tubes.
Oh, we had some of those things, but they mostly got busted.
And I don't suppose there's any money left to buy new.
No, sir. There never is.
Well, then, I guess we'll have to make do. Let's see. I can use an oil lamp for the Bunsen burner. Is there a swamp anywhere near? We can cut some reeds to use for pipettes. Now, show me where the trash dump is.
What do you want to see that for?
Well, if we can't buy equipment, then we'll have to make some. Let's go see what we can find.
The students look on amazed as the new professor of scientific agriculture clambered over the campus trash and garbage dump, picking up wire and twine, broken bottles for retorts, cracked china for mortars, an old flat iron to serve as a pestle. Then they showed him the land that had been set aside for the agricultural experiment station.
20 acres, eh? What crops have you grown here?
Well, we tried cotton once, but this land's too poor. Wouldn't grow nothing but bumblebee cotton.
Bumblebee cotton? What's that?
Cotton that grows so scrawny and weak, a bumblebee don't even have to flap his wings to fly up to it. All he has to do is hop.
I see. And it didn't pay.
Well, no, sir. We lost $16.50 an acre trying to grow that cotton.
I suppose there's no money to spend on fertilizer either.
Uh-oh.
Well, then, you better call all the agricultural students together for me. Tell them to bring buckets and baskets. Meet me back at the trash dump.
The trash dump? Well, why there?
There's a 37-foot pumpkin vine growing out of those tin cans. That's the finest plant I've seen around here. Must be good organic waste under those cans. We'll use it for our compost heap.
In time, Tuskegee grew used to Professor Carver's ways, for his ways were producing results. The barren acres of the experiment station were blooming miraculously under his scientific care. In 7 years, without the purchase of any commercial fertilizer at all, the soil had been so rebuilt that it was producing 6 times as many potatoes as before, 4 times as much cotton, a profit of $75 an acre instead of a loss of $16.50. And the tenant farmers flocked from miles around to tramp over the fertile acres with Carver and learn how it was done.
Plant diversification, that's how. Cotton is a deep, heavy feeder. It robs the soil of nitrogen, and when that's gone, the land is ruined. Rotate your crops. Plant a light, shallow feeder every other year, like soya, sweet potatoes, or these copy vines. Here. Take a look at these roots. See those little nodules strung along there like beads? They build nitrogen in the soil instead of taking it out. They'll return $25 worth of fertilizer to every acre and save you having to spend all that money to rebuild the soil. You're a sinner against the land when you stick to one crop, and your land will punish you for it. Diversify your crops.
George Washington Carver, the quiet scientist, working in the fields to improve the farmer's lot, in the laboratory to discover new products that would enrich their lives, traveling around the district every weekend on Tuskegee's mission of community service, encouraging people to plant green gardens, testing wells, advising on 1,001 other things, and everywhere preaching against the one-crop system that had made his people poor.
The boll weevil's coming. It's spreading into the district now, and nothing can stop it. If you stick to cotton, you'll all be ruined. Switch to soya beans or sweet potatoes for your money crop. Or better yet, try growing peanuts. You all know how. You've always kept a few vines at home for the children to eat. I tell you, the peanut has in it more proteins than sirloin steak. More fat than the finest butter. More carbohydrates than the best potatoes. And I say that if the boll weevil drives you out of the habit of planting nothing but cotton, then he'll prove the best friend the South ever had.
It was hard going trying to convince both the white planter and the Negro tenant farmer. But a few people listened and took the advice. One of them was a widow who managed a large plantation. When her first peanut crop was nearly ripe, she sent a hasty summons for Carver.
I thought you had a problem here. Looks like a fine crop you've got, ma'am.
Oh, there's nothing wrong with the crop. But now that I've grown them, what do I do with them? Eat them?
No. Better sell them.
Have you tried selling 100 acres worth of peanuts lately? I can't find a market. Brokers all say they get enough peanuts from Asia to fill every paper bag at every circus in America. And they can import them for 4 cents less a pound than I can afford to sell them.
4 cents less? But why is that?
They can dig them up cheaper with coolie labor. So what am I going to do now?
Well, I don't know. I'm sorry, Miss Watson. It's all my fault. I humbly beg your pardon. When I told everybody to switch to peanuts, I guess I didn't think the problem more than halfway through.
Back to his little laboratory went Professor Carver, profoundly shaken by this unexpected twist of events. Many people had trusted him, and now they faced ruin unless a new market was created for their two new crops, the peanut and the sweet potato. But how to create one? If he could find the answer, it might save the South. If he failed... Carver sat alone in his laboratory and thought. And because he had always been a deeply religious man, he finally called upon his creator for help.
I asked the great creator what the universe was made for. Ask yourself something more in keeping with that little mind of yours, he said. Then what was man made for? Little man, you're still asking too much. Then what was the peanut made for? Ah, that's better, the creator said. Though your mind is still too small to know all about the peanut. But God then said, behold, I have given you every herb bearing seed, which is upon the face of the earth. Try it, and there shall be meat. I listened. And then I carried the peanuts into the laboratory and took them apart. The oils, the fats, the rosins, sugars, starches, pentosans, pectoses, amino acids. And the creator said, now you know what the peanut is. And I asked, but why did you make the peanut? And he answered, I have given you three laws, compatibility, temperature, pressure. All you have to do is to take these elements and put them together in different ways, observing these three laws, and I will show you why I made the peanut.
For many nights, many months, Professor Carver worked late in his laboratory, trying one experiment after another, testing every possible combination, seeking new products that could be made from the peanut, products that would stimulate the demand. And then he packed the results of his research into bottles and jars and set out to interest industry in them. He spoke wherever he could find an audience, before civic groups, business clubs, trade associations, white audiences that never before had entertained a Negro as their guest speaker. And he won them all. In time, he won an invitation to face the most important and critical audience of all, the Ways and Means Committee of the House of Representatives in Washington, which for the first time was considering a tariff on peanuts to protect the American grower. The hearing was long, and tempers had grown short.
Next witness to represent the South and the peanut, Dr. George Washington Carver. Dr. Carver, before you take the stand, I see that it is now 3:50 and we were planning to adjourn at 4. Your time has been cut to 10 minutes.
10 minutes to sum up a whole life's work. It was not enough, and yet it had to do. Swiftly, Dr. Carver began to talk, unpacking his exhibits and holding them up.
Here is a peanut oil that is good for restoring the wasted muscles of polio victims. And in this bottle is peanut milk. It only takes 3.5 ounces of peanuts like these to make a pint of very rich milk or a quart of Blue John. We call it skim milk in our part of the South. They're using this peanut milk in the Belgian Congo today.
What for?
Well, they can't keep cows over there. If the leopards don't kill them, the tsetse flies will. So when a mother died, they always had to bury her baby with her. Now the missionaries are using peanut milk and saving the babies.
Well, can you make cheese out of that milk?
Yes, sir. It takes 100 pounds of cow's milk to produce 10 pounds of cheese. The same amount of peanut milk will produce 35 pounds of cheese.
What will the dairy industry say to that?
I don't think they'll like it.
Well, all right. How about ice cream?
This bottle is for ice cream. This one contains a good cereal coffee, also made from peanuts.
Do you make all these products yourself?
Yes. That's what a research laboratory is for.
Haven't you done something, too, with sweet potatoes?
Yes, indeed. 107 products in the sweet potato to date. But I haven't finished working on them yet. The peanut will beat the sweet potato by far. I have barely begun on it. Now, here is the latest thing. A face cream, soft and fine as almond cream. It is a vanishing cream that will take any perfume. And here are the products I have made synthetically from the peanut. Printer's ink. Washing powders. Metal polish. Savory relish. Mock oysters, Worcestershire sauce, butter, shampoo, creosote, vinegar, dandruff cure, soaps, wood stains, and 30 different kinds of dyes. Nearly 150 products and as many more to come. Why, if one knows a peanut, he can find food and shelter. He can produce medicine out of that same peanut. Washing powders also come. Face bleaches, candy, boards and to use in the wall of a home. God, what is a peanut, and why did you make it? Ye shall know science, and science shall make you free. Gentlemen, together, these things represent new industries worth $200 million to the South. I am not here today to discuss the tariff. I have nothing to sell. I will manufacture nothing. I simply came to add my little bit of information. I feel sure you gentlemen will know how to guard our interests without any suggestions from me.
When he was done, the 10 minutes originally allotted had been extended to nearly 2 hours. The committee's boredom and hostility had turned into rapt absorption. His collection of little bottles and jars had proved more powerful than the strongest argument. The protective tariff on peanuts was passed. What else can we say about George Washington Carver? How can you cover in just a few minutes a life of nearly 80 years, when nearly every moment was filled with a new discovery or a new achievement? He became a fellow of the Royal Society of Great Britain in 1916, won the Spingarn Medal in 1922. Henry Ford built a new laboratory at Tuskegee in his honor. Presidents and cabinet members came there to see him. Thomas Edison offered him $50,000 a year to join his staff. But Carver stayed on at Tuskegee at his same old salary, refusing all raises, refusing even to profit from his discoveries, desiring only to continue the work to which he had dedicated his life, bringing freedom from want to the people of the land he loved. With the things God put in the earth, and with the earth itself, he showed all men, both black and white, how to build a new South, a South no longer a slave to King Cotton. And perhaps his greatest achievement of all was summed up on that night in 1939, when 200 distinguished guests gathered in Theodore Roosevelt's home in New York to award Carver the Roosevelt Medal for Distinguished Service in the Field of Science and to honor him in these words.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have the honor to present not a man only, but a life transfused with passion for the enlarging and enriching of the living of his fellow men, a liberator to men of the white race as well as the black, a bridge from one race to the other, on which men of goodwill may learn of each other and rejoice together in the opportunities and the potentialities of their common country. I give you Dr. George Washington Carver.
You have been listening to Inheritance, presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with the American Legion. And now it's our privilege to hear from a past National Commander of the Legion, Mr. Stephen F. Chadwick. Mr. Chadwick.
The discoverers found America a land rich in natural resources. And as the years of settlement and exploration progressed, that land has yielded and continues to yield almost unbelievable wealth. Gold, iron, coal, and oil were found beneath the earth, and plant and animal life grow abundantly on its surface. But natural resources alone do not account for the greatness of the America of today. For above and beyond natural wealth, America has been blessed with a people, those who have come to be known as Americans. Who are Americans? They are the people and the sons and daughters, or more distant descendants of other people, who came here from all over this earth, people of every religion, race, and creed, blending the cultures and customs of every land, the strength and talents of all racial strains, to develop here a new, a broader, and more beautiful culture. Devoted to the thought of liberty and equal opportunity, our founding fathers devised, and in the Constitution of these United States have given us, a system of government designed to protect men in their God-given rights as free men. As the frontiers of opportunity offered by abundant nature are conquered, Americans in their inventive genius and cooperative enterprise continue to strive for the more abundant life. The ever-expanding mind of our people has preserved us a land of promise, of hope, and limitless opportunity. Geographical frontiers may pass, but frontiers of the mind are always open to a free people. Our inheritance is one of a constitutionally protected freedom, a freedom which is ours to enjoy so long as we respect the rights and freedoms of others. Let us as Americans pledge ourselves to so use that freedom as to increase our wealth of opportunity rather than diminish it. Let us preserve this, our heritage.
Thank you, Mr. Chadwick. Next week, Inheritance will take you on another journey through the pages of American history. Dr. Carver was played by John Marriott. Your narrator, David Goffin. The music was composed and conducted by Roy Shield. Inheritance was produced by William Welch and directed by Daniel Sutton. This has been an NBC Radio Network production.
Enjoy variety entertainment on the Dennis Day Show over most NBC stations.